Hare Krishna. Welcome to the final day of this seminar called The Essence of Bhagavad Gita. And today we are going to continue past the first verse of the Chatur-Shloki Bhagavad Gita. We talked yesterday about the first verse, text number 8 in chapter 10, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, and now we'll do the other three today. So, please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha namaum vishnupadaya krishna prishthaya bhutale shrimate bhakti vedanta swaminiti namine namaste sarasvate deve gauravani pracharine nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatya deshatarine. So, reading from Bhagavad Gita 10, chapter 10, called The Opulence of the Absolute. And this is text number 9. So if you know this verse, please repeat after me. Machitta madgata prana.
Machitta madgata prana.
Bodhayanta parasparam.
Bodhayanta parasparam.
Kathayantascha mam nityam.
Kathayantascha mam nityam.
Tushyanti cha ramanti cha.
Tushyanti cha ramanti cha.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. Purport. Pure devotees whose characteristics are mentioned here engage themselves fully in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Their minds cannot be diverted from the lotus feet of Krishna. Their talks are solely on transcendental subject matters. The symptoms of the pure devotees are described in this verse specifically. Devotees of the Supreme Lord are 24 hours daily engaged in glorifying the qualities and pastimes of the Supreme Lord. Their hearts and souls are constantly submerged in Krishna, and they take pleasure in discussing Him with other devotees. In the preliminary stage of devotional service, they relish the transcendental pleasure from the service itself. And in the mature stage, they are actually situated in love of God. Once situated in that transcendental position, they can relish the highest perfection which is exhibited by the Lord in His abode. Lord Chaitanya likens transcendental devotional service to the sowing of a seed in the heart of the living entity. There are innumerable living entities traveling throughout the different planets of the universe, and out of them, there are a few who are fortunate enough to meet a pure devotee and get the chance to understand devotional service. This devotional service is just like a seed, and if it is sown in the heart of a living entity, and if he goes on hearing and chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, that seed fructifies, just as the seed of a tree fructifies with regular watering. The spiritual plant of devotional service gradually grows and grows until it penetrates the covering of the material universe and enters into the Brahma Jyoti effulgence in the spiritual sky. In the spiritual sky also, that plant grows more and more until it reaches the highest planet, which is called Goloka Vrindavana, the supreme planet of Krishna. Ultimately, the plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of Krishna and rests there. Gradually, as the plant grows fruits and flowers, that plant of devotional service also produces fruits, and the watering process in the form of chanting and hearing goes on. This plant of devotional service is fully described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhilila chapter 19. It is explained there that when the complete plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, one becomes fully absorbed in love of God. Then he cannot live even for a moment without being in contact with the Supreme Lord, just as a fish cannot live without water. In such a state, the devotee actually attains the transcendental qualities in contact with the Supreme Lord. The Srimad Bhagavatam is also full of such narrations about the relationship between the Supreme Lord and His devotees. Therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam is very dear to the devotees, as stated in the Bhagavatam itself. Srimad Bhagavatam Puranamamalam Yad Vaishnavanam Priyam. In this narration, there is nothing about material activities, economic development, sense gratification, or liberation. Srimad Bhagavatam is the only narration in which the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord and His devotees is fully described. Thus, the realized souls in Krishna consciousness take continual pleasure in hearing such transcendental literatures, just as a young boy and girl take pleasure in association. Let's read the next two as well. Please repeat. Tesham satata yuktanam
Tesham satata yuktanam
Bhajatam priti purvakam
Bhajatam priti purvakam
Dadami buddhi yogam tam
Dadami buddhi yogam tam
Yenama mupayantite
Yenama mupayantite
To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Please repeat. To those who are constantly devoted,
to those who are constantly devoted
to serving me with love,
to serving me with love,
I give the understanding,
I give the understanding
by which they can come to me.
By which they can come to me.
And the last one. Tesham evanukam partham
Tesham evanukam partham
Aham ajnana jamtama
Aham ajnana jamtama
Nashayam yatma bhavasto
Nashayam yatma bhavasto
Jnana deepena bhasvata
Jnana deepena bhasvata
To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Please repeat. To show them special mercy.
To show them special mercy.
I, dwelling in their hearts.
I, dwelling in their hearts.
Destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge.
Destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge.
The darkness born of ignorance.
The darkness born of ignorance.
So, there is a type of fish called the salmon. You're familiar with the salmon? They live in mountain rivers, way up high on high altitudes. And a lot of salmon in Idaho, where I come from, northwest, a lot of mountains and mountain rivers. And they're born there, up in the mountains. And then they swim downstream to the ocean after birth, where they spend most of their lives. And then when it comes time to give birth to their own babies, they swim back upstream against the flow of the water, and mind you, going upward means height as well, because these are mountain streams, so you're not just going flat against the water. They jump up to 6 to 7 feet in height. They can jump, if they need to, out of the water in order to get over rocks and boulders and steps and so on, to go back to the exact place where they were born and give birth to their young there, who then repeat that process. There's a type of butterfly, I don't know,
the monarch
who spend the summer in northern areas, like northern United States, Canada, like that, and then fly all the way down south to Mexico and Central America to spend the winters. They migrate. Tiny little butterflies. There's some places in California where you can go to, and at a particular time of year, all of the trees will be covered with these beautiful leaves. But if you look closely, they're not leaves. They're just covered top to bottom with butterflies. Millions of them that come, and they look so nice, and then they fly on. Of course, birds do this all the time. And they have their favorite places to stay, and they rest in the same places every year when they do the migration. So it's not like they just find any place when they're tired. They have their favorite locations, and they stay in those spots. Like the Boise State University campus, where I study. That's a spot for Canadian geese when they're coming from Canada to migrate. And every year, the same birds will... Well, I don't know if they're the same. They all look the same. they all come and they rest on campus. That's their spot. And there's next to the river, and it's nice, and they can have water and food and so on. And they make a mess, and then they go. Right? Birds, butterflies, the fish, salmon, the penguins, you know, these emperor penguins in the bottom of the world? What's that
Antarctica.
Called? Antarctica, yes. Antarctica, they live there, and they give birth to their young on land, but they get food. Everything they need to eat is in the water, because naturally there's no life, basically, on the snow, on the ice. And so when they have to give birth, that's a long process, the process of gestation and then giving birth, and then the young are too little to put in the water, otherwise they'll be eaten by other fish immediately. So they trek all the way inland in the middle of the Antarctic winter. They can only do this in the winter, because in the summer the ice is too shaky to have babies on the ice. So they go all the way to the middle of the continent, give birth there, drop their eggs, the mother drops the egg, and transfers the egg to the father. Now, if the egg were to touch the ground, even for a few seconds, it would freeze and die. So they drop the eggs onto their feet, then waddle to the father, and push the egg to the father's feet, who then puts it in his pouch. Then the mother goes to feed. She goes, treks all the way back to the ocean, eats for a full month, stuffs herself, comes back to the center. Now it's 2 months have passed, by which time the father is very hungry, nearly starving. And she'll then feed the baby and the father and take the baby back. And now the father goes. Another 2 month journey, right, back and forth. And when they come back to the ice, if they're late by even 2 or 3 days, both the parent who's left behind and the child will die. Right? That's how close it is in terms of nutrition, how much they need. And the whole thing is ice, right? There is no markers. In pure white ice, you can't look at any, you can't see any changes in elevation. It all looks the same to the eyes. But they know exactly where to come, and they give birth in exactly the same place every year. The penguins, the salmon, the monarch butterfly, the birds. All these creatures know where to go, what to do, from the time of their birth. And to this day, no one has a good explanation as to why the butterfly or why the birds can find their way to the same place every year, stopping in the same location. If we had that kind of technology, it would be so useful for military applications, for flights and so on. It's far better than GPS or anything like that. And the best thing is it's self-sufficient. You don't need 3 satellites in the sky. You just have the one little bird and the group, and they travel along. So the point is, who is giving them all that intelligence to do this sort of travel, to find their way through? In Gita, Krishna says, Upadrasanu mantaja bharta bhokta maheshwara paramatmeti chapyukto dehismin purusha para. He says, in the heart, there's the paramatma, the supreme self, the super soul. Upadrashta, who's observing everything, anumanta, and he's giving his permission, his approval. Go ahead, do this. And he's showing direction. This is how you want to go. This is what you want to do. Why? Because he's Bharata. He's the supporter. And he's the great Lord, Maheshwara. This is how he defines Paramatma. He says, Paramatmeti chapyukto dehismin purushapara. There's another being in the heart, a supreme being, who is the Paramatma. And these are his characteristics. Krishna has put this intelligence of for people to find their way home in every being, this ability is there. You know the pigeon called the homing pigeon? Mm-hmm. They can train these pigeons to take messages, to go to some location and then find their way back, regardless of where they're put. You can take it 100 miles away somewhere and the pigeon will come back to its original home. Krishna has placed this ability in the hearts of every living being to find their way and especially to find their way home. Think about this. We go to the best vacation in the world, to some exotic land, and we have the greatest time in the world. And after that, where do we come back?
Home.
Home. And we look forward to coming back home, even from the best vacation. It's nice to finally come home, right? We go off to study somewhere. Where do we come back? Home. Right? We go and we settle in another place. And yet still, every year, Thanksgiving or Christmas or wherever, we have to come home. In every living being, there's this desire to come home. There's no word in the English language that evokes as much warm and fuzzy feelings inside as does the word home. If I say house, then you say, oh, it's a house. But you say home, and all of a sudden, it's something special. It's not just any house, it's home. So, the point that Krishna is making here, Tadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. He's identifying for us what is home. And he's saying that I will help that person, one who's engaged in my devotional service in this way, in the way he described in the previous verse. He says, I will give them the ability to come home. To come to me. And in fact, you see that Krishna has put this homing technology, Krishna has put this trademark of his own in all of us. From the beginning of history, of human history, we, every civilization, every people that we know of, from the Neanderthals in Alaska or wherever they were, down to modern man, in every civilization we know of, there was some attempt to find God, some attempt at religion, some attempt at spirituality. They used to think that the early civilizations didn't. They were just into food and eating and reproducing. But even with them, they find indications, discoveries, that suggest this was used for something more than just eating. It was some ritualistic purpose. There's no human civilization that hasn't thought about the question, where have I come from? Think about how much money NASA spends each year and millions of other institutions trying to figure out the origin of the universe, where we came from, how human beings were evolved, digging in the ground, searching for our origins. No? And you say, well, what's the practical use of this? Right? Science is supposed to give us practical things that we can use. By digging in the ground, looking for old bones, what are you going to gain? What will you understand if you understand the expansion of the universe? Oh, that in 10 trillion years it'll contract again? What use is that? But no, it's not a question of use. That's not the point at all. Every person, every civilization wants to know, where have we come from? What's our origin? We have a homing instinct built into us too. We're just like the pigeons. We're just like the salmon. We're just like the butterfly. We think we have more freedom, but Krishna has put the same instinct in us. We want to ask, where's home? And somehow we have this idea, this guess, this collective human memory that home must be where we started, where we began. Not where we're going, but where we started. Going is progress, but everyone's looking for their origin, the beginning, the start. These philosophers of religion, anthropologists, about 100 years ago, even less, more recently, 75, 80 years ago, they developed all these theories of religion, James Fraser was a very famous name. He was an anthropologist, a British anthropologist. And he developed this idea that the world went through three phases. The age of magic, he said, where everyone believed in superstitious things. Second, he said, the age of religion, where everyone believed in God and higher beings. And now, he said, we were in the age of science. And his prediction was that as soon as people enter the age of science and they realize the power of science, then religion will die. So in his, he predicted that maybe in one more generation, religion would start waning and it would go away. And in fact, from what we can tell, right, from studies and so on, exactly the opposite is happening. In our modern world, people's religious or spiritual instincts have become even stronger. Every pilgrimage in the world is becoming busier. Every temple is getting more congested. People are searching for spirituality in newer and newer ways. Far from dying, it's growing, it's expanding. Why? Because of this homing instinct. Because Krishna has placed it within us. Tadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantite. Everyone, he's pulling. Whether we know it or not, Prabhupada explains this very nicely, very beautifully. He says, everyone's asking this question, where is Krishna? We may not know it, but they're asking. The birds, they're chirping in the morning, they're asking, where is Krishna? The frog croaks and he asks, where is Krishna? He may not know he's asking for Krishna, but he is. Why? Because Krishna, he's anandam buddhivardhanam. He's the source of all ananda. The Upanishad says, satyam jnanam anantam brahma. Anandam brahma, they say. The Supreme Lord is ananda. He's bliss. He's the reservoir of all happiness. And because everyone is seeking that happiness, they're all seeking Krishna. They're all seeking Krishna in one way or another. Even those devotees who are very advanced, we think, oh, they found Krishna. And Prabhupada says, any devotee who's advanced, he never says, oh, I've seen Krishna, I have Krishna. The most advanced devotees, you know what they're saying? Where is Krishna? He Radhe Vrajadevike Chalalite He Nanda Suno Kuta Ghoshanta Viti Sarvato Vrajapure Khedair Mahavefalo Vande Rupa Sanatano Ragujugo Shri Jiva Gopalako. Srinivasacharya writes about the six Goswamis. They were so advanced that they could go from one place in Vrindavan to another and see Krishna's Leela happening before them. And yet they were calling out, He Radhe Vrajadevike, O Radha, Queen of Raja. He Radhe Vrajadevike, He Lalite, He Nanda Suno Kuta, O son of Maharaj Nanda. Kuta, where are you? Like this they were calling out, Ghoshanta Viti Sarvato Vrajapure, all over Vrindavan. Maybe you're at the base of Govardhan, or under the foot of a tree on the bank of the Yamuna. Where are you, my Lord? This is the mark of a pure devotee. He's thinking, I don't have Krishna, I'm looking for Krishna. You see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was always looking around. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? Never, oh, I found Krishna, I haven't. So, the point here, this seeking process, seeking Krishna, this is the perfection of life. This is what we're supposed to be doing full time, is looking for Krishna. But most of the time, most of us, we don't realize we're seeking Krishna. Whereas the devotee knows that he's looking for Krishna. We don't know what we're looking for, and the devotee knows exactly what he's looking for. That's the only difference between us and the pure devotee. Is we're bumbling about saying, I'm looking for something and I don't know what. You know, it's like that feeling you have, you get on a plane and you say, I think I forgot something. I think, what was it? Did we close the garage door? No. Did we, like in that film, Home Alone?
Yeah.
The first one? you remember the first one? I saw it when I was that little or something. And it was like one of three films I saw as a child. Just to be fair to my parents. I remember that scene. They're sitting all on the plane, right? The alarm went off. They put the kid up on the third floor, and they all ran out in a rush. And they get on the plane, and the mother goes, "I think I'm forgetting something." And the father goes, "The garage door? No, we got that. The stove? Stove is off. No. Did you lock the front door? Yeah, did that. Couldn't figure it out until they realized, Kevin, where's Kevin?" So we're kind of like that, right? We're going through our life going, "I think I've forgotten something. I need something. What am I looking for?" Right? And the devotee, he knows. Right? He knows where he's going. He knows what he's looking for. That's the difference. That's the search. So Krishna's saying that for someone who's always worshipping with me with love, I show them the path by which they can come back to me. I show them the way by which they can come to me. Dadami buddhi yogam. Now, the question is, who does he do this for? And in the previous verse, he explains it very nicely. He gives the qualities of someone who's a seeker of the Lord, who's looking for home. Machitta madgata prana. His heart is completely set on Krishna. Madgata prana. And she's completely given her life to Krishna. Bodhayanta parasparam. They spend all their time conversing about me and enlightening one another. And in this way, experiencing great satisfaction and happiness. Now, one of the things we get immediately from this verse, Bodhayanta parasparam, that devotional service can never be done alone. Okay? Because he's defining the devotee, someone who he calls own, by saying Bodhayanta parasparam. Bodhayanta means to tell someone else. Bodhaya is a causative form in Sanskrit. Bodhyati means to know yourself. Bodhaya means to enlighten someone else, get someone else to know. Parasparam means one another. It's the same word. Para, para. Parasparam. Each other. So this verse presumes that there's at least two people doing this together, if not more. The point is, devotional service cannot be practiced alone. This is one of the things that makes bhakti unique. The practice of karma, the practice of jnana, the practice of tapasya, the practice of dhyana, can not only be done alone, sometimes they're done better alone. In chapter 6, when Krishna describes dhyana yoga, he says, you should find a solitary place to meditate. So it's recommended be alone. But bhakti is a process that can never be done alone. I remember when I was living in Kentucky. This was the last 3 years I've been living in Virginia. Before that, I had a job in Kentucky in a little tiny place called Danville, a little village of 10,000 people in central Kentucky. The closest devotees were 2 hours away. The closest temple was 4.5 hours away. We were completely on a blank spot when it comes to devotee association in the United States of America. It was just sort of, if you make a map, it's a big, big blank spot. And we were smack in the middle of that. And I remember for the first time there thinking, wow, it's so difficult to be a devotee. My whole life, by Krishna's mercy, I was in very favorable circumstances for being a devotee. Growing up in a home, parents are devotees, and the temple was in our home, so Krishna was also right there. Then went to college, undergraduate was still at home. Graduate school, went to Oxford in England, where we were living in a house of devotees, 6 of us studying together for the same degree, in the association, and going regularly to Bhaktivedanta Manor, just 45 minutes away. Everything was nice. Then University of Florida, my first job. You may know there's Krishna Lunch program there. Wonderful community of devotees distributing prasadam on campus. No shortage of prasadam. After class is over, you can stand in line, have a good meal to eat, talk with other students, talk to devotees, go home, living right next to the temple, morning program next door. And then my first real job, a tenure track job in Kentucky. And all of a sudden, for the first time in life, Krishna took everything away. In one sweep, all association was gone. No temple there, no deities. I didn't have deities at that time either. My own, I mean. No prasadam other than what I had cooked myself. No opportunities for like day-to-day devotional service. No kirtan programs, nothing. Everything in one sweep. And it's at that point that I realized how difficult it was to do devotional service. And I realized what I was actually made of as a devotee. This is my... Because it's easy, and you're in the middle of devotees, and you think, oh, I'm such a nice devotee. See, I'm doing devotional service every day. And you don't realize how much of it is your own, and how much of it is coming from the devotees who are next to you and encouraging you. How much of it is coming from peer pressure? Because everyone's seeing you doing service, and today you decide, I'm not going to do my service. Right? How many people will call you up and chastise you, encourage you to come back? You know, something will happen, right? There's a certain amount of pressure there to do your devotional service. And there's always someone there asking you to do more. And our primary concern is what? To limit our service. No, Prabhu, I can't take that. I'm already really busy. I've got three things to do today. Maybe someone else can do it, or I'll find someone else to do it. That becomes our main cause for stress. And that's the way it was for me my whole life, is turning down opportunities. Oh no, too much, too much. And then Krishna took it all away. And I thought, wow, so how much of it is my own? Right? When there was no support, no devotees, I realized, well, maybe I'm hollow as a devotee inside. Maybe all that substance was coming from others, not from me. Can I be strong? Can I do it on my own? It was so difficult, so difficult. And then for the first time, I understood the meaning of this phrase that we sing every morning to Tulsi Devi. We say, Seva adhikaro diye koro nijadasi. Please give me the privilege of devotional service and make me your own maidservant. That word, privilege, such a nice word. Give me the privilege of devotional service. Not a right, not a burden, but the privilege of devotional service. I remember when I took driver's education for the first time. The big mantra that they were sort of hammering into us was that driving is not a right, it's a privilege. Right? They kept saying this. We can take away your license anytime we want. And there's no court in the world you can go to. Well, you can to at a lower level. But you can't go and argue on a human rights basis that every living being has the right to drive. It's not there in our constitution. It's not there in any constitution. It's not a right, it's a privilege. And that's what we realize in devotional service. Seva adhikaro diye. Give me the privilege of bhakti, of devotional service. So I remember during that time, I asked my spiritual master, Hanumat Preshya Goswami, I said, Maharaj, what do we do? How do we practice bhakti if we don't have association? If we're not surrounded by association of devotees? And he said, well, at first he said, well, you should try to create some kind of regulation in your life, some sort of regulated sadhana. You should get association through reading Prabhupada's books, and you should try to get association through hearing. Listen to classes, associate with devotees over the phone, and like that, things that that we would think of doing, right, if we were alone. Join conference calls and talk to devotees on the phone and email them and all kinds of things like that. Listen, go to ISKCON Desire Tree, listen to classes. But then the next day he came back after the morning Bhagavatam class and he said, you know, I thought about your question a little more. I think the only truthful answer to that question is you should not be without the association devotees. He said, there's no real way to put icing on that. If you don't have the association devotees, get the association devotees. Do whatever you have to do to put yourself in the association devotees. And he said, pray to Krishna. Krishna will help you. If you have a sincere desire, he'll help you. You can change your job. You can, whatever can happen. Your circumstances in life can change. And you can get association. But don't live without association. Because bhakti cannot be done without the association of devotees. It's not like it's more difficult. If we feel weak without the association of devotees, that's not because we're weak devotees. It's because we only have half of the ingredients we need for bhakti. Have you tried making a cake without flour? Does it work? No, you say, well, it's turning out to be a really bad cake. I put in the butter, I put in the sugar, but somehow it's not coming out just right, you know? But obviously, you missed the flour. Right? So, association of devotees is like that. We can't say, I'm outside of the association of devotees, I'm weak. There must be something wrong with me. No, it's just you don't have the process. Right? You're actually not performing bhakti without that association. So, he said, pray to Krishna, do something, change that. So at that point I decided to get married. I thought, okay, then let's find at least one other person, right, to perform devotional service with. And then we can make some of our own devotees, right, like that. And then Krishna was very kind. Within a year or two, then he... a job opportunity came up in Virginia, and we're quite close to devotees, relatively speaking. Half an hour away, 1 hour away. We have a nice bhakti viksha group there. So this is the first point here. Bodhayanta parasparam. Association is essential. And in that association, what happens? Tushyanti cha ramanti cha. The mark of devotee association. Because one question that arises immediately is, how do I know I'm associating with devotees? How do I know my association is devotional association? Like, what if you're a devotee and we get together and the only thing we ever do is watch football together? Am I in the association of devotees? How do I tell? Right? What's the criteria for telling, is this association of devotees? And Krishna gives that here. He says, katayantash jamam nityam. The mark of devotee association is that when those two people get together, what happens? Talk of Krishna. Talk of Krishna. That's the mark of devotee association. And in fact, you see this amongst devotees. This is what's so heartening, is you don't have to look only in the realm of pure devotees to see this. Even amongst us, relatively beginning in our spiritual life, devotees get together and somehow the conversation goes to Krishna. Today we were at lunch. And in the living room, there was big Krishna art book, darshan book. So just sitting there looking at the pictures and talk of Krishna came up. Then Damodar Prabhu said, well, I want to show you a beautiful painting I have of Krishna, commission. So I'll take you upstairs to show you. So it's something he received, something. It's natural to show things in your house to guests, right? But what was it about? It was Krishna. So you see this amongst devotees. Devotees get together and the talk turns to Krishna. That's the mark of devotee association. Now, this one here though, Krishna's upping the ante a little bit though. He's saying, katayantash jamam nityam. Always, eternally, continuously. And that's a little more difficult. Because we get together, we sit together, we do Krishna Katha. And then after an hour or so, then things sort of go in other directions. they don't stabilize there. So what does this nityam mean? Kathayantaschamam nityam. What does it mean to always talk about Krishna? What about our job, for example, and all the talking we have to do there that has apparently nothing to do with Krishna? Or what about school? Or what about the day-to-day family business we have to take care of? Something's wrong with the car, I have to take it to the mechanic, discuss where to take it, what needs to be fixed, how much we need to spend, what's our budget like. But where's Krishna? Where's Krishna? What does nitya mean? So Prabhupada explains this in Srimad Bhagavatam. There's this wonderful verse which says, Nashta prayeshva bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya. That one should engage in bhagavata seva, means service to devotees and reading of Srimad Bhagavatam. Nityam. Same word there. And how does Prabhupada translate that? Does anyone know? Nityam bhagavata sevaya? He says by regular attendance in classes on Srimad Bhagavatam and by service to the great souls. In the beginning stages of our bhakti, our devotional service, nityam means regulated. Right? Means regular. This is the goal we have to achieve first. Right? You come to me and said, you have to talk about Krishna continuously. And I'll go, I can't do that. I've got other things to do, frankly speaking. I can go to the temple, I can do it in the morning, but what about, I got other things to do. In the process of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, nityam means regulated, regular. That's what nityam means, daily, every day. That daily attendance on classes in Srimad Bhagavatam, daily glorification of Krishna through the holy names, daily telling of Krishna's stories, discussing them, daily association with devotees. And as we do that daily business, we become steady in our practice. It becomes regular every day. And once it becomes regular, then it starts becoming delicious. It's becoming tasty. Whatever you eat as a child, whatever your parents feed you when you're a little child, growing up, it's what you end up eating for the rest of your life. Means some things some people don't like, other people like very much. You grow up eating it, and you begin to like it. You go to an elderly person, and you say, well, here's some pizza, try pizza. Elderly Indian person. And they go, no, give me my dal and roti. Nice. You grow up eating pizza and you look forward to pizza your whole life. By regular practice, that becomes delicious. It becomes tasty. It becomes something you look forward to. It's just like practicing an instrument. You practice an instrument regularly, right? You play trumpet, no? Madhav? So you practice the trumpet, you practice the piano, whatever instrument you're playing, on a regular basis, which is hard work, to keep up the practice every day. And one day, what happens? You're able to sit down on that piano and sight read. Right? I could give my piano teacher any piece of music, she'd put it in front of her, and it would just come out beautiful. Spontaneously. And if you try, you think, let me try to play spontaneously. I just want to do that. Right? And I sit down on the piano and go, and it'll sound like what? Noise. Right? Not music, noise. Bang, 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 bang. It's not coming out nice. She's doing that. Right? She doesn't look at anything. She just goes, so I'm going to do that too. But no. What's the difference? Regulation leads to spontaneity. In order to be spontaneous, you need the training. That's one of the ingredients of spontaneity. People see these two things as opposites. One side is regulation. Oh, that's so formal and so boring. On the other side is spontaneity. These are not opposites. They're actually closely complementary. One leads directly to the other. An artist. Have you ever seen modern art? I'm not an art historian. I don't know anything about art. I look at modern art, and it just looks like splotches of paint. Someone threw some paint on a canvas. And so I think, I'm going to do it. I'll make millions. This painting is selling for $10,000. I'll make money. So I take paint, throw it on a canvas. Anyone going to buy it? No. There's method there. Right? I may not see that method, but that artist has gone through a lot of training in method in order to be able to then close their eyes and throw paint on a canvas and have it come out looking like art. Regulation and spontaneity. These two things are actually brothers. They're sisters. They work closely together. So nityam means regularly. Nityam means continuously. And these two things are not contradictory. Once we do it regularly, very soon we'll be doing it continuously. We won't be able to help ourselves. 25 years. My Guru Maharaj has not missed a single Mangalarti. 25 years. When he was a brahmachari, when he was a grihastha, when he was a sannyasi, not missed a single day, regardless of what was happening, whether he was sick or not. You can't do that unless you have a little bit of taste. Unless it became delicious at some point. You can't do it. You can't eat dal roti every day unless you like it. You could eat it once a week, but not every day. So, kathayantash chamam nityam, tushyanti cha ramanti cha. And as a result, they're always satisfied and very happy, ramanti. They enjoy this process. Now, clearly devotional service is very joyful. That's something that we all have experience of. Sitting in a kirtan, observing the deities when they're so beautifully dressed, having a good time with our devotee friends, doing some service we really enjoy. We know devotional service is very satisfying and it's very joyful. But it's not always. What about all those times when the devotees aren't satisfied and aren't full of joy? This tushyanti cha ramanti cha, this point that Krishna is making. What if we're not ramanti? What if we're not enjoying? What about suffering and problems? Difficulties? Can those be accounted for? Does Krishna recognize them? What if you're doing devotional service nityam, eternally, but then it stops? You fall. And the nityam has a break in it. Ramanujacharya, he says that our meditation on the Lord should be tailadharavat. He says, like a stream of oil. When you pour oil from one container to another, it should be like that, continuous. Not like a stream of water, because you pour water and what happens? The stream is all broken. It comes in pieces, or it spreads out, or it splatters here and there. But if you pour oil, beautiful, clear, completely steady consistency. Says taila dharava. That's how our meditation should be, continuous on the Lord. Queen Kunti says, my dear Lord, let my mind rush towards you. Ganghe vogham udanvati, she says, like the Ganga is rushing towards the ocean. Unstoppable. You could break any river, but Ganga just rushes towards the ocean. Let my mind rush towards you like that. But what if that stream of oil breaks? What if there's a dam in the river before it's going to the ocean? This happens, no? We've heard about devotees who've done service for years and then stopped. No? And given up their practice. And others feel bad about that disillusion. They give up their practice of bhakti. Perhaps we've experienced this in our own life. That we've had a break in our devotional service. We've had a time of lowness. Sometimes we experience it, no one notices, but it happens. If we be honest with ourselves, we've probably all been through some period where we were really low. We went on with our work, but our conviction was weak. So it doesn't stop, but the thread becomes, the dhara becomes really thin, very thin, hanging on by a thread. Just doing the externals, so no one notices. But inside, our faith is weakening. So this is natural. This is natural. My Guru Maharaj says that it's not a question of if you will fall from the path of bhakti. But the question is simply, when you fall, how will you pick yourself up again? Or will you stay fallen? It's not a question of if you will fall from the path of bhakti, but when you fall, what will you do about it? He writes to his disciples. He tells us that I'm also trying to practice this path of bhakti. I may fall from this path. And when we fall, then we will get up with full determination and keep walking again. He says, if Krishna is very, very merciful to us, then maybe we can get through this life without falling down. If Krishna is very kind. But this is the mood that we have. That if it were up to me, and if it were up to me, I would fall. If Krishna is very kind, I might be able to survive. So, it's just like a child learning how to walk. What's the likelihood that he's going to stumble? 100%, right? 100%. Krishna knows that. He knows we're taking baby steps in devotional service. He knows we'll stumble. Sometimes it's just a little one. Sometimes it's a big owie. And we really hurt. Sometimes we fall and other people fall with us. It's really bad. Even you know the story of Bharat Maharaj in Srimad Bhagavatam. You know King Bharat? Yeah. He gave up his whole kingdom and went to the forest. A successful kingdom where he was loved by everyone. He was wanted. It shows the power of renunciation. He wasn't kicked out. He wasn't disillusioned. He wasn't frustrated with his life. He was doing just fine. But the time came for renunciation. He said one day, I'm done. Right? We're going to the forest. We were talking yesterday about vairagya, right? Renunciation. Sometimes we feel that if I don't keep doing things, then nothing will go on without me. And that's part of our ahankara. Our feeling that, oh, the world will not go on. But we know that before I came, the world was running just fine. And after I'm gone, the world will keep going on just fine. But in the middle, those 80 years where I'm here, I'm so indispensable that nothing can go on without me. So we stay clinging. But all these great kings, from Maharaj Yudhishthira to Bharat Maharaj to King Anga, and so many of these great kings, they all showed this point. Time is up. Work is done. I'm off. He left. He turned around and left. That's how much renunciation he has. He went to the forest, spent all his time doing this. Machitta, matgata, prana, so on. Bhava samanvita. He came to the platform of bhava. That's one step below the level of prema, which is the highest level in bhakti. And he became too attached to a deer, lost his focus on Krishna, on a little deer. Right? Lost his focus on Krishna, poured all his affection on the deer, ended up thinking of the deer at the end of his life, and it took him two more births to go back to Godhead. That was from the level of bhava, that level of spontaneous devotional service. My point is this. Fall down itself, weakness on the spiritual path, is something to be expected. The question is simply, do we have enough humility to stand up again and keep going? This is the benefit that a child has when a child is learning how to walk. She stumbles, and then the minute she falls down, what does the child do? Get up and keep going. Right? It's not like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed and I hope no one saw me. In fact, they'll sometimes laugh, oh my God, what did I do? And then get up and keep going. That's the spirit. Okay, no, I have enough humility to say, this happened, but I need to keep on going. Keep on charging forward in my spiritual life. That's only one kind of difficulty. Is fall down. But what about the suffering that devotees go through? How can they be always remembering Krishna and happy in those circumstances? We talked about Queen Kunti's verse, may my mind run to you like the Ganges water goes to the ocean. And there's no one in this world practically, maybe Arjun, but the Pandavas, besides the Pandavas and Kunti, so devotees who had so much trouble, what Queen Kunti had to go through in the course of her life, losing her husband, and having her daughter-in-law insulted, and seeing her sons being threatened all the time, and the amount of suffering she went through. Actually, after the Mahabharata war was over, the Pandavas, they went to see Bhishmadev. He was still lying on his bed of arrows. And they all approached him and they were touching his feet and crying to see their great-grandfather in that condition. And Bhishmadev, he says a very famous verse there when he sees them. He says, oh, how wonderful is the influence of inevitable time. How wonderful is the influence of inevitable time. That you, who are dharma personified, right? Maharaj Yudhishthira, he was dharma raja, he was the son of dharma. You who are dharma personified, you have as your leader dharma himself. And Krishna as your personal friend, right? Arjuna's personal friend is Krishna. You had to face so many difficulties in the course of your lifetime. So many difficulties. And he says, this must be only the will of the Lord. The will of time, he says. Time is another form of the Lord. The will of time. Krishna can put his devotee through a lot of difficulty. Or karma can. There's one passage in Krishna book where Prabhupada says, he says, there's different ways in which we might react to suffering. The average way to react to suffering, the first thing that human beings do when they're in some trouble, what's the first tendency?
Why me?
Why me? Right? And even before that, we ask, who did it? We look for someone to blame for this. Who betrayed me? Who did this to me? So, sort of one level is, I get some suffering. What's the cause? You. You're the cause of my suffering. And we feel better. We sit down, we talk about it, we blame that person, they're so bad, we feel good. Okay, it wasn't me, at least. It wasn't my fault. Someone who's a little bit more advanced, they say, oh, it's not them, it's my own karma. That I had this coming to me from my past life. So we think, no, it belongs to me. I'm the one to blame because of something I've done in my past. But he says that a devotee doesn't even see it as his own karma. That's not the vision of the devotee. A devotee doesn't blame others, but he also doesn't blame himself. Note the key point here. You think, okay, what we're preaching is sort of a real depressing, you know, self-blaming business. It's not your fault, it's all my fault. No. Devotee karma means he's not blaming himself. I did something really bad. Okay, maybe there was. He's not blaming others. He's not blaming at all. What's the third option? It's not your fault. It's not my fault. It's Krishna's fault, right? No, not Krishna's fault. Yeah. Basically, he says that, right? Not Krishna's fault, but Krishna's mercy. Tesham evanu kampartham. He says, to show them special mercy, anukampa. Tesham evanu kampartham. Aham agnana jamtama. Nashayam yatma. Bhavasu. I sit in their heart and I destroy this ignorance. He says, no, this is Krishna's mercy. This destruction of ignorance business. Krishna sitting in the heart, shining the lamp of knowledge, destroying ignorance. The image is very beautiful, but the process itself can be a little painful. When Krishna deletes that ignorance, he cuts it out of our heart. It's something we're quite attached to, that ignorance. These are things that haven't just shown up there. We've lovingly brought them into our heart over the course of many, many lifetimes. And we're carefully guarding them there. So when Krishna decides to remove them from the heart, it's not easy. It's not comfortable. So one reason Krishna may give it, one way in which it might be mercy, is for the purpose of purification. To help us, this point of removing ignorance from the heart. Those anarthas, those black things in the heart that we might have. Krishna, he'll often put us in circumstances where we come face to face with all that is black in our heart. Krishna pulls it out of our heart and he hangs it in front of us. He says, ah, look, see, this is in your heart. And we see it and we go, no, 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 that's not mine, that's in his heart. Actually, he has the bad qualities. So Krishna says, okay. And sometime later he'll pull it out again. And he'll wave it in front of us and say, see, this came from your heart. And he'll keep doing this until we at least say, we admit, okay, that's from my heart. That's half the struggle. That's half the victory right there. If we can look at that and say, yes, that's from my heart. And he'll pull those out. He'll help us to see them. And he'll help us, he'll encourage us to throw them away. Whatever it might be, our pride, our lust, our greed, our whatever it might be, he'll take it out one by one in the association of devotees. And this is why that association point is so important. Because these things don't come out of the heart if you're alone. They don't. You don't see them. Because whenever we look in our heart, we see only good things. We look inside and we think everything's nice. We're comfortable. This is why a yogi can do tapasya for thousands of years, like Vishwamitra Muni. Right? He did tapasya for so long. Did he ever discover that he still had lust lying in his heart? No, not till Menaka came. And oh my God, all is finished. But to the devotee, Krishna is very kind. Because by putting us in the association of other devotees, oh, it's so much easier to run away. Sometimes it's very easy. We get some conflict, some little difficulty in our devotional service, or even big difficulty times. And it's so much easier to retreat, to say, no, I'll just do my own thing. Right? Me at home, bus. No? Sometimes we may have to do that just to cool down a little bit. But we always have to remember, we have to try again. Re-enter that association and try to work it out. Something else my Guru Maharaj says. All these nice things come to mind. He says, two people don't get along well together in a temple. This devotee is just getting on my nerves. Right? I can't stand him. The conflict, the upset. I can't deal with him, whatever it is. So I'm leaving. He says, you can go 1,000 miles away to the other side of the world, to another temple, to do another service, and you will find the same kind of person doing the same thing to you right in front of you again. You can see, you can, you can try this sometime. Well, don't try it. It's but it's true. It's true. Right? It's very true. That the situation that you're in, the trouble is, that person's not the cause of the trouble. The trouble is the product of the mind, of your own mind. You're seeing that person in a particular way, which is making that person exceedingly irritating to you. Prahlad Maharaj, he says this. He says, there are no friends and enemies in this world. Hiranyakashipu is saying, he's my enemy, Lord Vishnu. Prahlad is saying, there's no enemies. This is simply a creation of the mind. And so we go 1,000 miles away and we create the same circumstance. Because whatever anartha was causing that problem, we've carried that anartha 1,000 miles to our new location. And we'll be exhibiting it there. Much better is to go through. The only way out is through. The only way out is through. There's no way around. We have to go through. And Krishna, Lord Brahma, he gives a wonderful statement in Srimad Bhagavatam, a great message of hope. He says, Tattenu kampam susamikshyamanam bhunjana evatma kritam vivagam hidvag vapur bhir vidadhan namaste jiveta yo mukti pade sadaya bhag. Someone who is willing to go through and not turn back and not go around, but go through. Tattenu kampam susamikshyamana. Bhunjana, experiencing everything that comes. And we've been highlighting the negative here. Because, okay, that's sort of the opposite side of the verse. We shouldn't forget that there's a lot of wonderful things that come too. So much ananda in devotional service. So one who goes through all of this, experiencing whatever comes, whatever Krishna gives, the good and the bad, the happy and the unhappy, taking it as the mercy of Krishna, tate anukampam, same word here. Krishna is saying, tesham evanukampartham, anukampa, same word. One who accepts it as Krishna's anukampa, that yes, Krishna is cutting the ignorance in my heart, so it's surgery, so it's going to be a little painful. And says, okay, bhunjana. Bhunjana evatma kritam vipakam. And he says, and in this way he becomes vipakam. Cooked. Nicely cooked. Not raw anymore. Vipakam. So let's say ripe. Ripe is nicer. Ripe. Like a ripened mango. We become nice and ripe. Galitam phalam. Nice and ripe. Then, and this whole time, doing what? Hrid vag vapurbir vidadhan namaste. And offering obeisance to me with his hrid, heart, vag, words, vapu, body. Hrid vag vapurbir vidadhan namaste. Offering obeisances to me, saying, Krishna, I'm yours. Okay? Whatever you give me, it's okay. Just give me the strength to get through it. That's all. But I'm yours, Krishna. I'm yours. Then he says, Jivetayo, one who goes through life like this, Mukti Pade Sadaya Bhag. For that person, Mukti, liberation, becomes his rightful claim. Daya Bhag. At the end of your life, you can go and demand to Krishna and say, okay, where is it now? I've been through it. Mukti Pade Sadaya Bhag. That's a big deal. You become entitled. It becomes our inheritance, bhakti. And Prabhupada gives this example. He says, bhakti is our inheritance. Why? Because our father, our grandfather, is Srila Prabhupada. And his great-grandfather today, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And his great-father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Like that. Gaurakishore Das Babaji, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. We're children in this line, right? So bhakti, what are they passing down in this line? Prema bhakti. This is the wealth of this family, right? Every family has its wealth. What's our family's wealth? Prema bhakti. And what do you have to do in order to get your family's inheritance? Just live long enough, right? That's all you have to do. And one day you get your family's inheritance. So that's all we have to do. Right? Prabhupada says this point. He says, this is our inheritance. It's our rightful claim. We are proud to be in a family where prema bhakti is being given freely. So of course we're going to get it. But you have to live long enough. Jivetayo. We have to. Hidvago purbhir vidadhan. Yes, Krishna. I'll stick it through. I'll stick it out. I'll do what you ask me to do. And then at the end, where's my inheritance? Gopal Krishna Maharaj, he says this very nicely. We were discussing this yesterday in a small group. That so many lifetimes, we've spent satisfying our senses, our mind, struggling hard. Whatever amount of pain we think we might get in devotional service, I mean trouble, no pain, just some trouble. We've experienced much more than that, just trying to satisfy our senses and our mind. For millions of lifetimes. And are they satisfied? No, they're still demanding more. You've been at this endeavor for thousands of lifetimes, and all Krishna's asking is to give him just one lifetime. One. And even not a full lifetime. Right? How much of our life is already gone? We may not have been serious. Whatever's left, that's all what he's asking. And he's willing to give us the greatest inheritance. That's all. Imagine what a wonderful deal it is. Just one lifetime. In the spectrum of eternity, it's nothing. It's a little blip. That's all. That's all Krishna is asking. And he's willing to give us everything as a result. So that's his promise in these verses. He says, Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantite. I'll show you the way. I'll take you home. Just give me a chance. Give me one life. Give me one life dedicated to me, and I'll take you home. And I'll clear the path of whatever else may be stopping you. So, very powerful verses, very powerful promise from Krishna here in these essential verses of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is describing in the first verse, Sambandha. He's telling us who I am and who you are. Aham sarvasya prabhavo, matta sarvam prabhavate. This is who I am. I'm God Himself, the Lord of everything. And your role? Bhajante ma, worship me. So he's explained Sambandha. Next verse, Abhideya. He explains the process. Machitta madgata prana bodhayanta paraspara. This is what you need to do. Take pleasure in glorifying me and make sure you talk to someone else about it. Actually, this is another point I forgot to mention. This bodhayanta paraspara is a very key phrase. It implies two things. One we've talked about, namely, you need to do devotional service in association. The second thing is that you can't just be in that association. This requires you also have to give. Bodhaya is a causative form, as I was saying. You have to cause that remembrance in someone else. So, in other words, I'm in the association of devotees, and they're causing me to remember Krishna. But, parasparam, you have to turn it around. You have to find an opportunity to cause them to remember Krishna. Bodhayanta parasparam. So, outreach, sharing, preaching. We give Krishna, then we get Krishna. That bodhayanta parasparam. Very, very nice phrase. So this is describing abhideya, what you have to do. Always remaining satisfied and happy, doing my devotional service. And then finally, he's describing the end goal. I destroy that ignorance in the heart, I give you special mercy, and bhajatam pritipur. Now you have priti. Priti means pure love, prema. Right? Prema priti is the same thing. Pure love for Krishna is manifest in the heart. So the full process of bhakti from start to finish is explained in these four verses. Sambandha, who is Krishna, who am I? What is the process to re-establish that link? And then what's the end result? We get to go home. And Krishna shows us the path home. Okay, so I will pause here and see if there are any questions or comments, any areas for elaboration. Yes, Prabhu.
Yes, Prabhu, thank you very much. I really appreciate the point about the association of devotees.
Mm.
And just making the point of the whole world is so discouraging.
Yeah.
You know, in general, that it's very difficult to practice devotional service. And so just the emphasis of having very, very, taking every opportunity to give nothing but encouragement, at least outside of, you know, the devotional circle, is all discouragement, mostly. Mm. So when we are in, then maybe you can elaborate on the point of encouraging, because that seems to be, you know, sometimes we don't always do that.
Yeah, encouragement. This bodhayanta parasparam. Making others happy, ramanti. Making them satisfied by telling them about Krishna. This point of encouragement is very nice, because encouragement is that one thing which has the ability to turn hope into reality. If you encourage someone and say, wow, you're such a great mridanga player, then they will become a great mridanga player, even if they're not. So that's the power of encouragement. And when devotees exchange that kind of encouragement, even in the matter of praise, sometimes we say, oh, it's false praise, you know, you're just flattery. But no, amongst devotees, it's not like that. We praise someone's bhakti, we praise their devotional service. It encourages them to do their devotional service even better, even if they're not doing it completely purely. But it'll encourage you to think, oh, everyone's saying that I do the aarti so nicely, right? So maybe I shouldn't be thinking of work when I'm doing aarti. Maybe I should think of Krishna. So we try to live up to those standards. encouragement from devotees is how devotees give blessing. That's the form of ashirvada, or blessing, that devotees give. When a devotee says, oh, you're such a nice devotee, you do kirtan so nicely, that's the devotee's blessing, that may you do kirtan nicely. That's how we take it. We should take it. That this devotee's words will come true. Just like we were talking about yesterday, when Prahlad Maharaj says something, then Krishna, satyam vidhatum nijabhritya bhajitam. He takes the form of Nrisimhadev just to make sure the devotee's words come true, right? So in the same way, if a devotee gives us some encouragement, gives us some praise, we take it as blessing. The devotee said it, therefore I have faith that Krishna will make it come true. So these two things, encouragement and blessing, they go very closely together. We should not be afraid to give blessings. Naturally, different to different levels of devotees. But those who are our juniors, we should be very forthcoming with our blessings. This is our duty to give that mercy, right? Bodhayanta parasparam, to help them in their spiritual life. In the same way that when we need help, we expect blessings. We go to our guru, we go to a senior devotee, and we say, please give me your blessings, right? We expect blessings. So also we should not be afraid to give blessings. And sometimes the best way to give blessing is to give encouragement. So it's a nice point. Okay, you had a...
Yeah. After Chitra Shloka, Arjuna is sure Krishna is great, then why did the Bhagavad Gita still go on?
Okay, excellent question. This is actually the part that's we should cover. It's right after this. The question is, after these verses, Arjun says that he's convinced that Krishna is right. So he's asking, why does the Bhagavad Gita go on at that point? Why doesn't it just stop? Remember on the first day I mentioned how after hearing these four verses, Arjun has the reaction that Krishna says you should. Iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. You should feel something. You should love me. And Arjun has that reaction when he says, param brahma param dham pavitram paramam bhavan purusham shashvadivam divyam adidevam ajam vibhum. You're the supreme truth. You're the most wonderful. And then two verses after that he says, sarvam etad ritam manye yanmam vadasi keshava nahi te bhagavan vyaktim vidur deva natanava. O Krishna, I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. On Friday, we mentioned how this is the first time in the Gita Arjun has said that. First time, instead of coming back with a doubt, with a confusion, with a retort, he's saying, no, I accept everything you said. So why doesn't Krishna just wrap things up here and the Gita's over? Because he says, I accept as truth everything you've said, everything you've told me. But he still hasn't said one thing. One more thing. What is that? I will do it. I will do it. In the 18th chapter, after Bhagavad Gita is over, Arjun again says, Nashta moha smritir labdha. My illusion is gone. I know the truth. Everything you've said is true. He repeats that point. But he adds one more important line. Karishye vachanam tava. I'm now going to do what you asked me to do. And that's where bhakti begins. So far, yes, conviction is growing. But remember we were talking about on Friday that just because you know doesn't mean you necessarily have the courage or the conviction or the lack of fear or whatever it might be to actually go ahead and do it. That can still take some more time. Everyone in this country knows that smoking is bad for you, right? Yeah. So anyone who doesn't know, it's on every label of every cigarette pack. And yet to actually muster up the strength to stop, it can take a lot longer than just the knowledge can. So Arjun here, he's not quite there yet. At the end of the 18th chapter, he says, Karishye vachanam tava. Now I will do what you said. And that's important. That's crucial. That's when Krishna says, Okay, now we're done. Now we're done. Okay, a lot of hands. So I've got everyone here in mind. Let's take one from the back. Yes.
In the beginning, you said that, you know, that the ways the fish tries to go back home, and then the butterflies try to go back home. So home seems to be a good spot to be in. So materially speaking, when we are born, is it rightful to stay near your place of birth? Is it wrong to travel too far away and settle there? Mm. Is there
Materially speaking, home is a good place. I mean, it's one of the symptoms of Kali Yuga that no one has any stability or any tie to home. Right? We're very proud of our jet-paced mobile world. You know, tomorrow I'm heading off to Europe, and you know, next week I'll be in Hong Kong, and then I got to get back in time for my son's birthday, and then after that, next morning I'll be off. And we're like, oh, that's a sign of success, right? Wow, you're a real business traveler. And you fly business class too? It's really like... But actually, according to Vedic civilization, this is a sign of great loss. That you have to run around. There's no anchor. It says in Bhagavatam that this is one of the symptoms of Kali Yuga. People running from here to there, here to there. There's the story of the little prince. I don't know if the kids may have read it, but he comes from another world, and he lands on Earth, and he's at a train station, and he sees a train going this way, and he says, "Where are they all going?" And he says, "Oh, they're going to Birmingham." And then he sees a train going this way. He says, "Where are they all going?" He says, "Oh, they're going to London." And then train going. He says, "Why are they going back and forth, back and forth? What's the point?" Right? Prabhupada said, "It's just like thieves." Thieves, they're running here and there, here and there. So we're trying to loot Maya. And so we're going on this, he says, this motor car civilization, Prabhupada said. Zoom, zoom, zoom on the highway. And it says in the time of King Vena, this Vena was a terrible king in Bhagavatam. He's sort of the antithesis of all the good kings. It says that the dust created from the hooves of the thieves, from the hooves of the horses that the thieves were riding, to steal and rob people, it created so much dust that it would obscure the sun. And if you look at our civilization today, it's the same thing. We run in motor cars back and forth, and if you live in Los Angeles, you can't see the sun. Not because of clouds, but because there's this thick of a layer of smog between you and the sun. So this is not sattvic civilization. You know, sattvic civilization means, so travel means I was born here and then I went to the next village. Krishna, you know, first time he left Vrindavan, how far he went? Mathura. How far is Mathura? 20 kilometers? Right? And it was the end of the world for the Brajvasis. Today, if you went 20 kilometers, right, how far do we live from the temple? More than 10 miles? Would anyone cry? Would our husbands or wives or children cry if we went to the supermarket 10 miles away? So this is not sattvic, you know. But what can we do? We live in a civilization where practically you can't maintain a job anymore unless you're willing to move. If I wanted to get a job near Boise, Idaho, I couldn't. Right? Impossible. This is where... So anyway, this is a material point. But in terms of spiritually, then we realize, okay, wherever I'm at, I have to look towards my ultimate home. That's where I really need to be focusing my attention, is home, back to Godhead. Okay, Mati?
The example you gave us about the animals, the penguins and the birds, and are we in a state of purgatory since the animals have a natural instinct to go home? Logically. And as human beings, we listen to other humans versus listening to our spiritual self. So does that lead us in a state of purgatory because we don't have one guidance, but we have man to guide us, where their interpretation of what guidance is? So then we are does that put us in a place of purgatory here until we finally find our end point spiritually?
It's a place to learn, to reform. I'm not sure what you mean by purgatory. If it's some way of sort of us getting the suffering we're due, the punishment we're due, then I think that's okay. There's karma. We get what's due to us. But it's a place of learning. It's an educational institution. It's an institution of reform, this world. That's basically what it is. It's nice to think of it like that, as an educational institution. It's like a university or a college.
I guess my ultimate question is, just like the animals have a natural instinct because they just know what the right thing to do is, why as humans we don't have that natural instinct? We're always in the search of. Why don't we just have that natural instinct like animals?
Animals don't have a natural instinct to know the right thing to do. They just have a natural instinct to do what they need to do to survive, right? And human beings have the same thing. We know we need to set up home. We know at a certain age we have to look for the opposite sex, whether we like it or not. We get those desires in our heart. We go out looking for a partner. We get married. When we have a child, we naturally feel protective over the child. A mother will lay down her life to protect her young. Right? We have so many instincts that Krishna has given us. The animals are no better than us. Right? They have natural instincts, but it's not like they have an instinct to go back to Krishna. They have an instinct to do what they're supposed to do in terms of survival, right? In terms of how they need to reproduce. And we have those same reproductive instincts. Like Prabhupada is saying here, it's natural for a young boy and a young girl to become attracted to each other. No one has to teach them how to. That's an instinct that Krishna has given our species, so that we can do the same thing the salmon are doing, which is reproduce, or the same thing the penguins are doing, which is to reproduce. Right? So we have the same instincts that the animals do. To survive, to reproduce. There's four instincts, according to Bhagavata. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending or fighting. Right? These four things we have in common with the animals. And it's all versions of the same instincts. In ourselves, we like to not think of it as instincts. That's too animalistic. Right? So we say, oh, I wanted to marry that person, or I fell in love with that person. But it's the same thing that happens to an animal in a particular season. They want to mate. They look for their partner. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending are the four common instincts to every species. And Krishna has given us those same instincts too. But what we need to do is find the underlying instinct that's driving even those, the big instinct. And that's to go back to Krishna. That's what we need to recover. Yes?
Prabhu,
you had your hand up.
Yeah, so regarding the suffering you mentioned, so when the suffering comes, the devotee thinks that it's the Lord's mercy, it's the Krishna's mercy. Now, even before coming to the Krishna consciousness, or before even becoming a devotee, the suffering was there as well. Mm-hmm. So now also, even after coming back to Krishna consciousness, or becoming as a devotee, still the suffering exists.
Mm-hmm.
And the suffering is being undergone.
Mm.
So now, now the devotee may think that it's a mercy of the Lord. So how do we, even before the mercy of the Lord was there in the form of suffering?
Mm.
So what's the difference, basically?
Yeah, that's a good question. Even before you became a devotee, the suffering was there. So wasn't Krishna's mercy there? And the answer is yes. Krishna's mercy is there for every living being. The only question is, do we recognize it or not? Can we accept it to improve ourselves? In the example that Prabhupada gives is that of the rain. The rain is falling on concrete, and it's falling on the earth, and it's falling in the water. The concrete cannot appreciate the rain. It can't use it, it can't absorb it. But the earth can, and so many flowers and fruits grow from it. In the same way, Krishna's mercy is being showered on everyone, in good ways and negative ways, both. But the question is, can we recognize it, and can we use it to help improve our spiritual life? That's the only question. And if we can learn to use it nicely, then it can actually be very, very beneficial. It's just a difference in perspective. That's all. The experience itself, what's happening to us, is not different. Devotees get cancer. Devotees have car accidents. Devotees go through everything, like everyone else does. But it's a question of perspective. Are you going through it knowing that Krishna is carrying me, or are you going through it feeling like you're all alone in the world? And a devotee knows, no, I'm not alone. Krishna is there with me. Just like that song, Footprints in the Sand. You know this song? It's a very nice song about how a person recognizes that in the most difficult periods of my life, Krishna was there. We may not see it, but Krishna was always carrying me all the way through. So it's a change in perspective, that's all. Devotional service is a change in perspective. It's actually not a change in much else at all. Very little changes, but perspective. Okay, you remember.
I just thought it was interesting before, earlier, when you said that we don't have a right to devotional service. You were talking about the association at that time, maybe? You know?
It's a privilege, yes.
Yeah, we don't really have a right to it, it's a privilege. And the reason why I thought that was interesting is because it's our constitutional nature. Devotional service, and therefore, like our birthright, and so it seems to.
Yes, that's a good question. Is it not our nature? Is it not our constitutional position? And therefore, is it not our birthright? And the answer is yes, it is. Right? It is our birthright. But we have to want it. In other words, Krishna is not going to force it on us. And so, this is why the devotee's perspective should be that it's a privilege. It's that Krishna's giving this to me, it's a privilege. This should be our perspective. In other words, that we should never take devotional service for granted. Because when we take it for granted, we devalue it. And when we devalue it, then our desire to have devotional service becomes weak. And the only qualification to get devotional service is the desire to have it, is the intense greed to have that devotional service, right? So that's why it said that it's a privilege, that we should always think of it as a privilege. And this is why Krishna sometimes takes away the opportunity, just so we develop that mood. It's not that he ever can completely divest us. You're right. We're Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nitya Das. This is who we are. We're the servant of Krishna. But Krishna is never going to force that on us. He's never going to say, now you serve me. Because this is not what he wants. And so therefore, he sometimes takes it away, like playing hard to get, so that we develop this mood, oh, I really want it. It's a privilege to be able to serve Krishna. And if you see, this is the mood of all the residents of Vrindavan. They consider it a great privilege that, you know, every coward boy, he thinks, I don't know what I did, why I'm so lucky that Krishna considers me to be his best friend. He's not thinking, oh, I live here in Vrindavan, so, you know, like, who else does Krishna have to play with? Right? He's got no choice. He's stuck with me. No, he's thinking, I'm so lucky that Krishna chose me as his best friend. So his mood is a privilege to serve Krishna. It's a privilege to pack Krishna's lunch. It's a privilege to cook something for him. That's the mood of the devotee, which then makes devotional service always something that we hanker for, that we look forward to, and not take for granted. In any relationship, if we start taking that relationship for granted, then the relationship goes down. If a husband and wife, they think, oh, it's a privilege to be with this person, then the relationship will be healthy. Clearly, it's also a right, right? You've got a court marriage, so it's a right. You have a right to be with that person. But if you think of it as a right, then a little shaky. But you think of it's a privilege to be with this person, then the relationship is nice. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Krishna. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Krishna. We should think, yes, it's a privilege to serve the Lord. That should be the devotee's mood. Yes.
Lord Buddha was one of the Dashavatara. Then why he carried the same point of
It's a good question. Lord Buddha was an incarnation of the Lord, so why did he have a perspective that wasn't in agreement with what Krishna's teaching? He taught a version of impersonalism, basically, or voidism. And it's said that sometimes Krishna, as we were saying yesterday, the material world is sort of set up as a place where Krishna allows you to have any perspective you desire, and he gives you the facility for that perspective. So if you want to forget Krishna, Krishna will help you. If you want to think you're Krishna, Krishna will provide the facility for that. If you want to think that Krishna doesn't exist, I killed Krishna, Krishna will provide the facility for that. Right? So Krishna gives the facility for us to maintain any perspective we want here. This is free for all. And so Lord Buddha comes to give us a very, very strong way in which we can maintain this perspective that there is no God, no God in control, which actually fits very well with the whole ethos here in the material world. So Krishna is very kind like this. He comes and he presents a view. Shankaracharya did this. He was also empowered by the Lord. Lord Buddha did this. He was also empowered. He'll send his different people. He'll come himself sometimes. Empower others mostly. And send sometimes perspectives that are off balance, not the Siddhanta. Also, Lord Buddha, he played a very important role in that he stopped the misinterpretation of the Vedas. At that time, the Vedas, two things were happening. Number one, the Brahmins were misusing their position to monopolize spiritual life and to oppress all those below them. It's a mark of Kali Yuga. And Lord Buddha came just around the beginning of Kali Yuga, a little after. And second thing, they were using the Vedic sacrifices as a way for mass animal slaughter, to kill animals. And these two things had to be stopped. Because Bhagavatam says that that's the one thing that will make your heart so hard that you'll find it difficult to develop bhakti, is when we're killing others, other living entities. So Krishna, he came to stop these two misuses of the Vedas. And people were defending that perspective based on the Vedas. So he came as Lord Buddha and said, okay, if this is what the Vedas say, then throw out the Vedas. Reject the Vedas. They're useless. And so he completely rejected the Vedas. This is why Buddha philosophy is considered nastika, atheistic, because the authority of the Vedas is rejected. So he had a very specific role to play there. And Krishna sometimes does things step by step. He doesn't reveal the full Siddhanta until much later. Yes, Prabhu.
Can you speak about, so, you know, this is a common phenomenon we've seen around, but if someone's new, you know, we spend a lot of time with them, they're very encouraging. But then very often in temple relationships, you know, you see people frequently, but all you have is like very superficial surface relationships. Mm-hmm. And for us to really realize the importance or the meaning of association of devotees, it's critical, not just important, to develop these deep relationships. Mm. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, this verse is all about those relationships, right? The second verse, bodhayanta parasparam kathayantascha mam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha. This is all about relationship. If we were to ask what is devotional relationship, what is devotional service even, then Nectar of Instruction defines that so nicely. How does it start? Guhyam akhyati prichyati bhungte bhojayate chaiva dadati pratigrihnati. Giving, receiving gifts. Giving prasad, receiving prasad. Revealing your mind in confidence and hearing what someone else has to say in confidence. These are shadvidha priti lakshanam, six symptoms of love between devotees. And what's Krishna talking about here? Tushyanti cha ramanti cha. They're always satisfying one another. They're very, very happy. So what does that mean? Guhyam akhyati prichyati. It means revealing your mind and hearing what others have to say. Developing deep relationships. But the key word in that verse is guhyam. Is doing it confidentially. This is one of the biggest problems in relationships, not just amongst devotees, but even outside. You go in the workplace. You tell a colleague about something, you're sure trusting that person, revealing it. Pretty soon, within 30 minutes, the whole office knows. And everyone knows what you were talking about. So then this betrays trust. It betrays trust. So building confidential relationships, revealing one's mind and hearing what they have to say, this is a very important part of bhakti. So devotee relationships are the heart. They're the heart of the whole process, as we see here. We cannot get Krishna without that. Without that. And everything else is born from those relationships. From sadhu sangha comes bhajana kriya. From bhajana kriya comes anartha nivritti. From anartha nivritti comes nishtha. And sadhu sangha means, this word sangha is very, very crucial. Sangha means attachment. Krishna says so many times in Bhagavad Gita, he says we have to become asanga, nirsanga. Without sangha means material attachments, material association. So when we say sadhu sangha, what does it mean? That the same level of attachment I have to the material world, I should have to devotees. That's pretty strong attachment. We spend our whole lives trying to fight our attachment to material things. Think about the thing you're most attached to in this world. And think, that level of attachment I should have for devotees. That's sadhu sangha. Krishna uses this word in two different ways. He says, sangat sanjayate kama. From the sangha, from the association we have, kama. Those are the types of desires we'll develop. Those are the types of desires. Sangat sanjayate kama. Yeah, so there's so many things we could say about this. It's a wonderful point. Devotee relationships are the heart, there's no doubt. Someone, yes, in the back, very far back.
You mentioned that our nature is the material.
Huh.
And also I heard also that Sakya Rasa or Madhuri Rasa is superior to that.
Yes.
How do you justify?
Yeah, so Sakya Rasa, Madhuri Rasa, if our nature is service, how do you put those together? You see, service to the Lord is the heart of every relationship. Even Madhurya. Even the highest relationship, the heart of that relationship. So I should say the foundation of that relationship is service. Is dasya. Even the gopis are thinking, how can I serve Krishna? How can I please Him the best? And how can I get someone else to serve Krishna? This is bodhayanta parasparam. So without the mood of service, there's no relationship with Krishna. That's the basis. You see, Kansa was also thinking of Krishna day in, day out. Just like the gopis. 24 hours a day. But what was the difference? There was no mood of service there. Service was missing. So service is the foundation of every relationship. Unless we develop the mood of service to the Lord, then other feelings cannot even develop. And if they do develop, then they won't be very long-lasting. They'll be superficial. It'll just be on the level of sentiment only. Okay. Mataji in the back? Yeah, so this is a very practical question, right? Very practical question. Suppose we do have a situation where there's a problem with another devotee or someone we're working with, or something that needs to be brought to someone's attention. Right? Something is clearly amiss, and we're having trouble doing our devotional service, and we sincerely want to. We don't want to retreat, and there's a problem. Okay? So what do we do in that circumstance? You see, the scriptures warn us a lot about offending devotees, Vaishnava aparadha. And we certainly should not do that. If we go and we backbite or we talk about someone else behind their back, then this is Vaishnava aparadha. But if we go to someone who is our superior or is their superior, or we go in a respectful fashion to them directly, that's not Vaishnava aparadha. That's taking the proper channels to address the concern that we have. And we may even be doing a favor to that devotee. We see something that's clearly amiss, or perhaps they need help in some area, and we find the right channels to provide them with that help. So it's all in a question of how we approach it. The main thing in devotee relationships is transparency and being straightforward, right? Simplicity, that's the heart of it. If we're simple in our dealings, and simple means what? That what I say to this person about you, I should be able to say to you. Or at the very least, to someone who you trust. So if we go to that person's superior, or to someone we regard as a superior, and we express our mind, or if we're able to, we think they'll accept it, we have the courage to go to that person directly and talk to them nicely about it, then that's not performing Vaishnava Aparad. Means they may not feel very happy about it, but that's not Aparad. Right? Aparad happens, offense happens, when we talk about them to someone else, and in this way, take away their opportunity to do devotional service. If I'm making garlands for the deities, and you don't like the garlands, and you go and complain to someone that he's making bad garlands, and that goes around in the devotee community that I make bad garlands, then my ability to make garlands for the Lord is gone. Right? It's taken away. So that's when it becomes offensive to a devotee. So there's, it's not that, oh, okay, devotional service is a process only of navel-gazing, of self-introspection, always blaming ourselves. No, remember, it's not blaming ourselves, it's not our karma, but saying it's the mercy of Krishna. So if Krishna's put me in a position where I have the ability to change something or to help someone, how can I do that in a reasonable, in a nice fashion without causing hurt? So then we have to sometimes avoid or change our service or retreat. Sometimes we have to do. It's not a blanket thing, you know. We try. We have to try. If we've tried to address authorities, we've tried to speak to the devotee directly, we've tried to work it out in our own hearts, and it still doesn't happen, then maybe we have to avoid or change our service. Or avoid the situation in some way. Or retreat. Maybe Krishna is saying, okay, then you have to retreat. Maybe it's an opportunity. Krishna is pushing us to change our service. Something like that can happen every once in a while. I'll just end with this one point because it's getting time for Tulsi Puja. Is that my Guru Maharaj, he always says that in spiritual life, it's better to duck than to fire arrows. Like if someone shoots an arrow at you, duck, right? You stand up to receive it, you're going to get hurt. You fire an arrow back, you might hurt them. So duck, right? Try. But it's something difficult to do. It's difficult to duck. Because what's grihastha life without a good fight? Isn't it? As grihasthas, this is what keeps us going. We haven't fought with someone for a while, so we get together around the dinner table and say, oh, aisa hai, dekha usne kya kiya, and we do all this criticism business. Huh? And we create an enemy, and it makes us stronger as a family together. We're all together, because we hate that person together. So as grihasthas, we have this urge. Grihastha life, what's grihastha life without a good fight? But we have to try to fight that and say, no, I don't need to fight. How about let's duck? If Krishna gives me an opportunity to hold that person's hand so he doesn't fire any more arrows, I'll take that opportunity. But let's try not to fire arrows back. Let's duck when we can. And if the arrows don't stop, then okay, we look for other ways. But usually, this is not always the case, but usually there's only a couple arrows that come. Right? Means that devotees are usually nice enough, reasonable enough, that someone will shoot an arrow at us, something will come out. And if we duck that one arrow, life will go on and our relationship will heal. And we shoot back with another arrow and we've just begun a war. We've just begun a war. So we have to give it the benefit of doubt. Try ducking once, try ducking twice, maybe three times. And if it's still you're getting arrows, then okay, let's think, what can we do? But hopefully, usually, it'll go away before that. Krishna will help. I think it's time for Tulsi Puja. It's just 2 minutes, and we don't want to keep Tulsi Devi waiting. We can definitely discuss more later. The last part of this seminar will actually be the Sunday Feast lecture, where we'll talk about the essence of the essence of Bhagavad Gita. Okay? One special verse, not one of these. Thank you very much.